All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the fifth part of our series, The Law and the Law, sponsored, as always, by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas, Yona Ben Rav Arya Leib. So it'll be a wild ride tonight. Just as there have been enormous changes in American life regarding race relations, so too America and its relationship with religion has a very convoluted and unsettled history, and present as well. Especially the last 40 years, things are constantly in flux. So many issues have been visited and revisited. Matters that were traditional and thought settled have been reevaluated. We're going to look tonight at the basis will be the case of Lenin versus Kurtzman and the Torah's view of religion in the public sphere, but many other cases we'll look at as well. America is a religious country that's founded on principles of religious freedom, especially governmental non-interference with religions. The Pilgrims and the Puritans each came seeking such freedom. So in fact, religious freedom is built into the DNA of America itself. And the U.S. is unique in that respect. The Jews had an agonizing and lugubrious coexistence with Christian Europe. Our relations with Christian America have been almost the complete opposite, 180 degrees. And it was Eisenhower who probably expressed the American uniqueness in this way. He said, "Our government makes no sense unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith. And I don't care what that faith is." Meaning, one can practice any religion, doesn't matter. But in America, everyone practices some religion, and the key factor is that no religion can encroach on some other person. Such an attitude was unprecedented in the history of the world. So how is this freedom reflected in practice? What was, for almost a century and a half, a little longer than that, with a number of different religious insertions into the culture that were very common. Prayer in public school. Most of us here grew up, even though it was fairly recent, with the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. Exemptions from churches, from certain taxes, not to mention clergy. Sensitivity towards atheists also. Public displays of religious symbols, nativity scenes, always a hot topic this time of year. We'll discuss it tonight as well. The interesting case, going back almost 20 years, the use of peyote, a narcotic, in religious services. Is a person allowed to practice his religion if his religion involves using drugs? Is he allowed? The Ten Commandments on a courthouse wall. All of these, not long ago, were discussed and deliberated, and in modern times, all approaches have been rooted, for better or worse, in the case of Lenin versus Kurtzman. But first, some general background. The very first amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the very first of the Bill of Rights, was that, I quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." And that's really our discussion tonight. Both clauses are somewhat in conflict. We'll see. The Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Congress cannot establish any religion, nor can interfere with people's free exercise of that religion. And both clauses have undergone dramatically different interpretations over the years. Partly, this is a consequence of Jefferson's famous letter to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1801. They had certain complaints, and he wrote to them, "Believing with you," and this really expressed the American ethos, "believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of the government reach actions only and not opinions. I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared," in the Constitution, "that the legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." That phrase is not in the Constitution. It was in Jefferson's letter here, which had a life of its own. The first word itself gives us a clue to the coming developments. because Congress shall make no law. Well, Congress has almost never made any law regarding establishment of religion. Many of the practices outlawed by the courts over the years were not at all the result of congressional action. That itself was the product of an extension of the Bill of Rights to the states, known as the Incorporation Doctrine, which itself is somewhat controversial. In the 19th century, it was well settled that the Bill of Rights applied to the federal government and not the states. So, for example, you had many states that had religious tests for holding public office. Only a Christian could hold office or vote. In state elections, local elections, not federal elections. But the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, we discussed it last time as well, 1868, began the process of applying the Bill of Rights to the states, and slowly almost all of the freedoms in the Bill of Rights became mandatory in the states as well. Now, the Establishment Clause was first related to the states in this case, Everson versus Board of Education, 1947, which has ramifications for us today, as all these cases do. The court first applied the Establishment Clause to, in this case, to the states. Everson was a nudnik from Ewing Township, New Jersey, which is in Mercer County near Trenton, and he protested that the defendant, the Board of Education in Mercer County, was reimbursing parents of both public and parochial schools for school transportation. And he claimed that violated the Establishment Clause, that it's fine if the state pays for transportation of public school students, but if they pay for transportation of parochial school students, then they are establishing a religion, as the Constitution would understand it. Both sides on the court reaffirmed the wall of separation, but the majority, a 5-4 decision, ruled that bus service reimbursements were, I quote, separate and so indisputably marked off from the religious function that they did not violate the Constitution. That is why we get free bus service to yeshivas if it's provided to public schools until today, based on the Everson decision. Justice Hugo Black wrote the decision. Listen to what he said, because you see, it hasn't always been applied in practice. Quote, "The Establishment of Religion Clause of the First Amendment means at least this. Neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church." In fact, that's what it meant. Like Britain had an official religion, America was not to have an official religion. That's the pshat. "And Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." But, he continues, "neither can pass laws," meaning state or federal government, "which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another. Neither can force nor influence a person to go to or to remain away from church against his will, or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. No person can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs, for church attendance or, say, I have to say, non-attendance. Now listen to this. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion." That one sentence alone. Think about it as I speak tonight. How then does the government pay chaplains on its payroll? There's a chaplain that opens, for example, every session of Congress or the legislature. Every session, paid by Congress. How could that be? They're using tax money to pay these people. It existed when Black wrote it. Somehow, he never thought it would be a conflict. I continue, "Neither a state nor the federal government can, openly or secretly, participate in the affairs of any religious organizations or groups, and vice versa. In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state." This was a 5-4 vote, close vote. The minority disagreed, including Felix Frankfurter, and we'll see that the Jews are always against any expansion of religion or encroachment of government involvement in religion in the country. The minority argued that since tax money is being used, it constitutes impermissible aid to children attending parochial schools, even indirectly, and thereby the government is paying for their education. Well, to that the response would be, but is that an establishment of religion? Is anyone being forced to attend a secular school? Rather, the same benefit accruing to the secular student is accruing to the religious student. Otherwise, the Establishment Clause will be used to prevent the free exercise of religion. Religion will be unduly encumbered by the government if the government penalized, in a secular, neutral process, students who wanted to study religion versus students who went to public school. To one extent or another, these two arguments will recur in almost every ensuing case. The other incorporation case reflected the second pole of the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, Cantwell versus Connecticut, 1940. So Connecticut required mendicants, schnurrers, they call them here religious solicitors, to obtain a license before going door to door. By the way, there's the same regulation in Teaneck. It's just not enforced. Not just religious solicitors, but all solicitors. Newton Cantwell was a solicitor. He was a Jay's witness. He was arrested for soliciting without a license, and the court ruled unanimously that restrictions that were religion-based were illegal, meaning if the government wanted to outlaw or mandate that every solicitor, even for March of Dimes, needed a license, then they could do that. But they can't say only religious solicitors need a license, because that requires the government, the state, to decide which are religious, which are not, and then to discriminate. That can't be. Well, those are really the two cases from which everything else flowed, the agreements and disagreements thereafter. But the case that really shocked, opened up the eyes of the public, was the prayer in public school case. Prayer in public school, many of you can tell me better, was a feature in American life. Public school included Navidad plays and carols, and if you ask me, it likely kept Jews attending public school from assimilating, as they had to reinforce their Jewish identity themselves. Since they abolished prayer in public schools, so assimilation has become much worse. In Engel versus Vitali, 1962, a New York case brought by a combination of atheists and Jews, atheists probably were Jews also, the court ruled that the promulgation of official state school prayer violated the Establishment Clause. Because if there's prayer in public schools, it's as if the government is mandating a religion. Even if it's neutral prayer, mentions God, not anything Christian. Nonetheless, overruling the New York court's decision. It's a separate case, Abington School District versus Shemp. Shemp here is not the brother of Moe and Curly, if you're thinking, but rather Edward Shemp, who was a Unitarian, and in Pennsylvania, each school, or in this district at least, in Abington, began the day with Bible reading, 10 verses without comment. Each student was called upon each day to read 10 verses, and that was it. And the court held that Bible readings and other state school-sponsored religious activities were prohibited. Both in 1963, Engel was 62, and thus began the march to secularism, which characterized the 60s and thereafter. That, as we know, has since produced values-free students. They don't teach values in the public schools anymore because of this. So values-free education has produced values-free students and citizens. Now, bear in mind the idiosyncratic irony of these rulings. Ruling unconstitutional practices that were obviously sanctioned by the drafters of the Constitution because they existed when it was drafted. So that itself shows right away the difference between Torah law and American jurisprudence. I've mentioned many times, Torah law, psak halacha, is usually process-oriented. That is to say, there's no specific conclusion in mind that you shape your precedence around. Whatever it is, most cases. Sometimes try to make you lagun, etc. But the average case, whatever the halacha is, that's what you try to determine. Whereas the latter Supreme Court jurisprudence, especially the last 50 years, is almost always result-oriented. Meaning the result is predetermined. The judges, each one knows what they want, and then they marshal sources in order to obtain the necessary legal support for the decision. And if there are no sources, they make it up, as we'll see next month in another case. The banning of school prayer, as you could well imagine, was both supported and hailed, they filed briefs in fact, by the American Jewish Committee and the Synagogue Council of America. Frankfurter himself had suffered a stroke during the deliberation, so he didn't vote, but the vote was 6-1, and it represented typically the philosophy of American secular Jews, who've always had a fear of religion in the public domain. It exists until today. And basically, this built the foundation of an attitude towards Judaism that essentially was anything that was not Christian. If you just renounce or denounce Christianity, then you're a Jew. But do anything or embrace anything that's remotely Christian, that can't be done. Abington, by the way, was a Pennsylvania case that was consolidated with another case whose young plaintiff was the son of Madeline Murray O'Hare, the infamous atheist. All of this led to Lemon versus Kurtzman, another Pennsylvania case, 1971, a related dilemma to what we discussed in Everson. The question was, can a state reimburse a religious school for the salaries of teachers and the cost of textbooks for the secular studies in that school? Now, it sounds very reasonable, because the state would have to provide the secular education anyway. I have to tell you that I have been on a campaign regarding this specific point the last 10 years, and take it to the highest levels of government, both state and federal, because it makes no sense to me. There's no reason why, logically, except of course the Supreme Court, there's no reason why a state should not have to pay for the secular education of our students, which they would have to pay for anyway if we sent them to public school. They should defray that cost. It makes perfect sense. We'll get some money out of our contributions to the school tax collections. It makes no sense. The fact is, we do them a service, at least, by providing a building and paying utilities and giving religious studies on our dime. But their dime should pay for what they give everyone else, similar to Everson. Sorry. It may yet happen, because Lemon itself has been whittled away and is challenged by conservatives. But the court disagreed here, and they carved out what has become known as the three-pronged test for religious encroachments in the secular sphere in America that's used l'chatchila until today. So to be constitutional, a statute must have, one, a secular legislative purpose, two, it must have principal effects which neither advance nor inhibit religion, and three, it must not foster an excessive government entanglement with religion. If any one of the three is not there, the statute is unconstitutional. Now note, the issue that they're dealing with, let's take the simplest case, where the yeshiva is not even responsible for hiring the teachers, as is the case here, but the public school provides math teachers, science teachers, etc. And they have the curriculum also. Does the statute have a secular legislative purpose? Absolutely. Does it have the principal effects of advancing or inhibiting a religion? No, because they're teaching secular studies. Does it foster an excessive entanglement, government entanglement with religion? It might or might not. It doesn't have to. Especially if the school district is responsible for administering the secular studies, it shouldn't have to. Nonetheless, they did. I can quote from the decision. The court found that subsidizing parochial schools further the process of religious inculcation, and that continuing state surveillance necessary to enforce the specific provisions of the laws would inevitably tangle the state in religious affairs. The court also noted the presence of an unhealthy, divisive political potential concerning legislation which appropriates support to religious schools, meaning it wouldn't be popular with the public school parents because it would take money out of their system, as if that is a cogent argument. Now, there was another law challenge in Lemon versus Kurtzman. It was a Rhode Island law that gave a 15% salary supplement to parochial school teachers who taught only secular studies to bring their salaries up to par with their public school peers, meaning the parochials pay them less, and this increase brought their salaries to the same level. It failed under Lemon as well, because I could see it, why it would fail, because even a greater involvement in religion. But nonetheless, the essential question of why they can't pay for secular studies for our students, I don't understand it. Lemon has been severely criticized for its restrictions on the free exercise clause. So how is this different than Everson? In other words, why should the government be allowed, according to the court, to provide bus service, which is secular and neutral, and not be allowed to pay for secular studies, which is secular and neutral? What's the nafgamina? Chief Justice Berger, candor compels acknowledgement, moreover, that we can only dimly perceive the lines of demarcation in this extraordinarily sensitive area of constitutional law. Translated into English means they didn't want the backlash because they would take away bus service from parents who had gotten used to it in the ensuing 30 years, 25 years. They said somehow we'll keep that as constitutional, but this not. But of course it makes no sense. And once again, the court rejected the simplest understanding of the Establishment Clause that Congress or the states are simply prohibited from establishing an official state religion. No one in his right mind would ever think, just like they pay for bus service to yeshiva establishing religion, if they pay for a math teacher, they're establishing religion as well. Now, Lemon was further extended in a 1990 case, Lee versus Weissman. Robert E. Lee was a middle school principal in Rhode Island, where the practice was, in the high schools too, they'd always invite a clergy to deliver an invocation at graduation. So Robert E. Lee invited a rabbi. Not that many Jews in Rhode Island, but nonetheless. And Weissman, of course, sued. Did not want to subject his daughter, Deborah Weissman, to hearing the words of the rabbi. The district court dismissed the suit. The graduation took place. Rabbi Leslie Gutterman delivered this invocation. Now tell me if anyone here is offended by it. That's a public school, but nonetheless. He said, "God of the free, hope of the brave, for the legacy of America where diversity is celebrated and the rights of minorities are protected, we thank you. May these young men and women grow up to enrich it. For the liberty of America, we thank you. May these graduates grow up to guard it. For the political process of America, in which all its citizens may participate, for its court system, where all may seek justice, we thank you. May those we honor this morning always turn to it in trust. For the destiny of America, we thank you. May the graduates of Nathan Bishop Middle School so live that they may help to share it. May our aspirations for our country and for these people who are our hope for the future be richly fulfilled. Amen." That was the invocation. Then he continued with a benediction. "O God, we are grateful to you for having endowed us with the capacity for learning, which we have celebrated on this joyous commencement. Happy families give thanks for seeing their children achieve an important milestone. Send your blessings upon the teachers and administrators who help prepare them. The graduates now need strength and guidance for the future. Help them to understand that we are not complete with academic knowledge alone. We must each strive to fulfill what you require of us all, to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. We give thanks to you, Lord, for keeping us alive, sustaining us, and allowing us to reach this special happy occasion. Amen." Anybody offended by that? Oh, good. It's a good audience. What's that? If you're an atheist, you might be offended by it. Like Weissman must be an atheist. Okay. One of the things that the court pointed out,
Karen's offended.
No. One of the things the court points out is that he quoted a pasuk. Asos mishpat, avas chesed, vasten leches melokecha. Michal. That's right. Very good. We read, and Kennedy pointed in his decision, that's a verse from the Bible. What he wasn't sensitive to, not a big Talmud Chacham, is that the last line, Shechiyadah. Keeping us alive, sustaining us, allowing us to reach, especially, that was Shechiyadah. He didn't realize that. The Supremes reversed the district court 5-4. With Anthony Kennedy, it's 1990, Anthony Kennedy, then is now the swing vote. I mean, the Obama health care is going to be dependent on Anthony Kennedy. And we'll see how tenuous that is. Kennedy wrote, state officials here direct the performance of a formal religious exercise at secondary schools' promotional and graduation ceremonies. Lee, and he was the principal, Lee's decision that prayer should be given and his selection of the religious participant are choices attributable to the state. Moreover, through the pamphlet and his advice that the prayers be non-sectarian, he directed and controlled the prayer's content. That the directions may have been given in a good faith attempt to make the prayers acceptable to most persons does not resolve the dilemma caused by the school's involvement. Since the government may not establish an official or civic religion as a means of avoiding the establishment of a religion with more specific creeds. The establishment clause was inspired by the lesson that in the hands of government, what might begin as a tolerant expression of religious views may end in a policy to indoctrinate and coerce. Prayer exercises in elementary and secondary schools carry a particular risk of indirect coercion. That's the key phrase, because thereafter, whatever engenders indirect coercion, what's that? That's something like people feeling uncomfortable was illegal thereafter. Like you said, if there's an atheist who might feel uncomfortable, then it can't be done. Of course, it's very selective. Maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, I was invited to the Congressional Prayer Breakfast in Washington. President Bush had made it into a major event every year. He spoke. It was in a hotel in Washington. And Condoleezza Rice spoke. In 10 minutes, she quoted canon law, Talmud, and Sharia, just to be on the safe side. And then a minister gave a benediction. All right? At the very end, he mentioned Jesus. And I was sitting at a very nice chat that morning with Eric Cantor, now the majority leader, and he said to me, they're not supposed to do that. Just say, God, you can't make it Christian. So I said to him, forget about it. What's the difference? I didn't answer amen. That was it. Went back to my fruit. There's no live and let live anymore. That's what it is. Here, Kennedy said, there was a subtle and indirect public and peer pressure on attending students to stand as a group or maintain respectful silence during the invocation and benediction. Is it really so bad? Sit, don't sit, stand, don't stand. We've traveled very, very far from Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Here there's no Congress. There's not even a state official, as we would normally understand the role of a school principal. No one looks at a school principal as an agent of the state. The pendulum has swung so far already that it almost completely vitiates the second clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In dissent, the dissenter, like in many of these cases, was Anthony Scalia. Justice Scalia is a strict constructionist. And obviously, this was permissible when the Constitution was drafted and ratified. He wrote, in holding that the Establishment Clause prohibits invocations and benedictions at public school graduation ceremonies, the court, with nary a mention that it is doing so, lays waste a tradition that is as old as public school graduation ceremonies themselves, and that is a component of an even more long-standing American tradition of non-sectarian prayer to God at public celebrations generally. As its instrument of destruction, the bulldozer of its social engineering, Scalia never spares words, the court invents a boundless and boundlessly manipulable test of psychological coercion, meaning whatever might make someone feel uncomfortable, we have to stop that. Anyway, I continue. Today's opinion shows more forcefully than volumes of argumentation why our nation's protection, that fortress, which is our Constitution, cannot possibly rest upon the changeable philosophical predilections of the justices of this court, but must have deep foundations in the historic practices of our people. The history and tradition of our nation are replete with public ceremonies featuring prayers of thanksgiving and petition. And he goes and starts the list, to wit, the Declaration of Independence, the annual Thanksgiving proclamations from the President, inaugurations, which are always preceded by invocations, congressional sessions always have invocations, etc. And this is what's most fascinating about the case. It was a 5-4 vote. And Anthony Kennedy had first voted in favor of Lee, not in favor of Weissman. He was assigned to write the decision. He wrote the decision accepting this prayer, and then something happened, and he said, I don't like it. And he switched to the other side. That is what you call a swing vote. Unpredictable. He swung even during the deliberations. What if they want to worship? What if it doesn't come from the state? What if it comes from the students? They want to do it themselves. So the final straw, so far, was in Santa Fe Independent School District versus Doe. Doe here was a Catholic and a Mormon. 2000, in which students voted to have a pre-football game prayer. Every week a different student, they'd vote who it was, what it would be, which at the end of the prayer invoked the name of Jesus. Court Rule 6-3, that even prayer on school property, at school-sponsored events, over the public address system by a speaker representing the student body, under the supervision of the school faculty, pursuant to a school policy that explicitly, implicitly encourages public prayer, are not private but public speech. To which Chief Justice Rehnquist dissented. He said, and this really also stamps the area and the mindset that we're in, he said, this opinion bristles with hostility to all things religious in public life. If you think about it, the school provides nothing. The state provides nothing. It's the microphone at a football game in which the students compete. The students do everything. Nonetheless, the court took that right away from them. And he said, to try to fit into Lemon, the policy itself, letting the students have a prayer, has plausible secular purposes. To solemnize the event, to promote good sportsmanship and student safety, to establish the appropriate environment for the competition, etc. That's why, by the way, whenever there's a suggestion there should be a moment of silence in public schools, it's also vetoed on this basis. Now, the Lee Court had ruled, one of the reasons why they said that prayer was not unconstitutional was because they said it was unreasonable to expect a student to miss graduation. But is it so unreasonable that those who object here to a prayer that mentions Jesus at the end, they just said, don't go to the game if you don't like it. And even at graduation, they weren't asked to pray, just asked to stand. Here, if the grievances were that strong, to stay home. I remember when I graduated college, there was a religious service, a private college, but nonetheless, it was a religious service. I didn't attend. I didn't think anything of it, so I can't attend. I didn't want to attend to begin with. But nonetheless, Karen disagrees. Must the majority's rights be so constricted in order to protect the feelings of a small minority, even one person? One person objects to something, you're going to take it away. Well, that's what the court holds, but it is in contrast to almost 200 years of American history, which said the exact opposite. What about the national motto, "In God We Trust"? What about the addition of "Under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance? I mentioned it's new. That was added to Congress, added to the pledge by Congress in 1954. And as you know, it was challenged by Teaneck's own Michael Nudow, another Nudnik. Your neighbor, who grew up here, a Jew, became an atheist, or an atheist became a Jew, I don't know, one or the other, moved out to the left coast. After he sued because he didn't want his daughter saying "Under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance. After the zany Ninth Circuit out in San Francisco ruled the phrase unconstitutional, the Supreme Court, that 2002, in Elk Grove United School District versus Newdow, essentially punted. They didn't decide the case on the merits. They just said that Newdow has no standing to sue on behalf of his daughter because he was the non-custodial parent. They were divorced. His wife had custody, so she was the one who could determine whether she, the daughter, would be offended by this. And Newdow's ex-wife decided, under God, doesn't bother her. All right, you, my ex-husband, you bother me. So therefore, the court dismissed the lawsuit, but they did, and they reversed the Ninth Circuit, but they did not entertain the constitutional challenges. That parsha has not ended. In this context, I add, as I mentioned earlier, Employment Division, Department of Human Resources of Oregon versus Smith, 1990. The court ruled that Oregon can deny unemployment benefits to a person fired for using peyote, a narcotic, in his religion of the Native American church. In other words, there's a law in Oregon that if you're fired, you get unemployment benefits unless you're fired for drug use. Smith was fired for using drugs, but he claimed he used his drugs. It's like the kiddush people make 8 times Shabbos morning. He was fired for using drugs. He said his drugs is part of his religion, the Native American church. Surprisingly, a not more popular religion. Scalia wrote that the state's ban on peyote, so hallucinogen, was a neutral law of general applicability and that the state has a compelling interest in banning narcotics. So in that case, again, the contraband law superseded the free exercise clause. And finally, we come to Inyana Dioma of this week, and that's County of Allegheny versus ACLU. 1989, the court issued a long, convoluted, confusing, and much disputed decision that adjudicated two matters. The presence of a nativity scene in the courthouse, in the staircase of the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania courthouse, Allegheny County. And separately, at the same time, they adjudicated as well the presence of a menorah 18 feet high next to a Navidad tree outside the Pittsburgh County building. Now, interestingly, the tree itself was not litigated. I guess even the ACLU has limits. The menorah, of course, was the work of Chabad, and they were a plaintiff in this suit. The circuit court had ruled that all displays violated the Establishment Clause. In all, this County of Allegheny versus ACLU, 9 decisions were written, and a bare majority was mustered. The nativity scene was ruled unconstitutional in a 5-4 vote, but the menorah was ruled constitutional in a 6-3 vote. Somehow, these major decisions just depend on personalities. Rehnquist, Scalia, Whizzer White, and Anthony Kennedy ruled that both were constitutional. All were constitutional. Brennan, Stevens, and Thurgood Marshall ruled both unconstitutional. Harry Blackman and Sandra Day O'Connor were the deciding votes. They ruled the nativity scenes unconstitutional and the menorah constitutional. How did they arrive at this conclusion? Through some very nifty contortions. And they each arrived at their conclusion separately, different reasoning. They ruled categorically that the tree is today a secular symbol in American life. Now that might be news to Christians, even though historically the tree is a very late innovation to the festivities. Blackman held that the menorah, similarly, is a secular symbol, just reflecting the holiday season. That's hard to sustain. We'll get back to it in a moment. Whereas O'Connor held, more plausibly, that the menorah again had been next to a tree outside the county building, the menorah, if it stood alone, would have been an endorsement of Judaism. But because it was placed next to a tree, it represents freedom of religion that America celebrates. You disagree with Sandra Day. They both held the creche was unconstitutional. I told you it was contorted and convoluted. They both held that the creche was unconstitutional because it represents a particular religion. All right. And the menorah doesn't? What's the logic here? Kennedy, who wrote the major dissent, disputed this, and he raised the whole history of America, founded largely by Christians, for whom these displays are meaningful, and he said, just like the court endorsed him in a separate case, Marsh versus Chambers, in 1983, the court ruled that government funding for chaplains is constitutional. Why? Remember Everson? You can't use any tax money for any religious purpose. Why is that constitutional? In 1983, the court said, it's because historically, the U.S. always had that. Introducing sessions of the legislature. So that's bizarre. But we also had school prayer. We also had nativity scenes. We also had graduation prayers. So why is the matter of the chaplains something that has historical import, but nothing else is? The creche is also part of American history in the sense that Americans always had it. No matter, the menorah and the tree were in, the nativity scenes were out, except if privately sponsored, and even then, the courts have litigated numerous times through the relentless attacks of the ACLU, usually with Jewish support, whether the particular location where the menorah is placed has any nexus at all to any state or local entity which would render it unconstitutional. I'll mention only one of the cases related to this, and you'll see that it really boggles the mind. So, of course, these cases came up long after I and my brother graduated law school, but I would have loved to sit in the class to hear any professor try to understand the difference between one and the other, both in the previous case of County of Allegheny versus ACLU and these cases. Listen to this. McCreary County versus ACLU, McCreary County versus ACLU of Kentucky, 2005, the court ruled 5-4 that a display of the Ten Commandments in the county courthouse was unconstitutional. The very same day, 2005, in Van Orden versus Perry, the court ruled that the display of the Ten Commandments on the grounds of the state capitol in Texas is constitutional. All right, how could that be? Stephen Breyer was a swing vote. In the courthouse, he said no. On the state capitol, he said yes. What's the difference? It makes no logical sense. But Breyer said it's all context. Why? The state display was privately funded. It's a monument set into the ground. It's been there 40 years already, etc. But it's still on state grounds. If you have a clout, you have to apply the clout. Hard to figure. All these decisions were ridiculed by Scalia, who said the court is now engaged in protecting people from possible misperceptions of their own making, that no reasonable person would ever assume, if there's a Ten Commandments hanging in the courthouse, that the government is trying to advance religion in any respect. And he said further that in McCreary, in the courthouse case, the display was one of several displays, all the same size. They're hanging on the wall, essentially a wall that was devoted to the origins of laws in America. It had the Ten Commandments, it had the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and God We Trust. It had all of that. All right? It was the display of the Ten Commandments that offended the ACLU and had to be taken out. But in the state capitol, there it was allowed. Well, some decisions are risible, and properly so, in part because they are inherently illogical. Well, what does the Torah say about all this? Now, obviously, to deem the menorah a secular symbol is demeaning. Whatever Blackman claims, a menorah is a chesed mitzvah. And the mitzvah of Hadlakas Ner Hanukkah has a very precise form, with additional hidurim. Granted, a tree is not like that. Years ago, I gave a riff on a tree, you know, if the Jews had such a mitzvah. The ten tefachim, that's give a certain amount of shade, you know. We have, you know, tzilasa merubah hamasa. We have all sorts of halachic principles that apply to it. And a menorah doesn't. Very specific. The basic mitzvah is near issue veso. Emphasis here on the veso. What is a menorah in a public place? It's a court, town hall, a shopping mall, have to do with a bias. According to many opinions, there's no such mitzvah. So the whole legal struggle, and it's always Chabad, is a wasted effort. In fact, it's arguable whether, in fact, Sume Nisa, publicizing of the miracle, applies to Jews only, or even to non-Jews. After all, Mikra Megillah is same achaya persumei nisa, but we don't run to do it in public so non-Jews could hear it. So why should a menorah be different? The Rebbe writes about it at length, and that's why they do it. But most poskim struggled to understand why the bracha we make in shul on a menorah is not a bracha of atala, because not a bias. At least a shul has the advantage of zecher lemikdash. Town hall does not have that luxury. So all these parties, you know, my wife was invited to the governor's party Wednesday night, so I'll accompany her. Very nice, but it's nice to be there, but, you know, why is he lighting a menorah? He doesn't light Chabad lights, but nonetheless, it's in his mansion. President Obama, he's a liberal, so he had Hanukkah 2 weeks ago, alright? So that bracha must be bracha vatala in any event. For me, Christian symbols in public don't offend me at all. America is a huge majority Christian country, and as long as the government does not encroach on my freedoms, I shall respect others. I don't feel a need to compete with them. To me, in fact, it's a denigration of the entire idea. I cringe. I'm tired of Hanukkah. What's Hanukkah? I cringe when I see the tree and the menorah together, because Hanukkah represents the purity of Jewish tradition and the struggle to retain our identity free of alien ideologies. So we're essentially diluting the menorah by commingling it with other religious symbols, which are even the very antithesis of the menorah. The trees and nativity scenes don't bother me. I don't understand why Jews feel it incumbent to make these public displays. And if anything, the Christianization of December is a reminder, a good reminder, that we're in Golos. As pleasant an exile as it is, if I do not want to be bombarded with Christian symbols, I can make Aliyah. So now I embrace a live and let live, but unfortunately few others do in America. On the broader issues, so obviously the U.S. and the Israeli systems, or the Torah state systems, will be different. But let's talk about Israel for a moment. America is one of the few countries with an absolute separation of church and state. Many democracies, Britain, Italy, Europe has plenty of them, and South America too, openly have state churches with guaranteed freedoms to minority religions. Really, Israel's a hybrid, because the Megillat Atzmaut guarantees to all the state's inhabitants chofesh datu matzpun, freedom of religion and conscience, safa chinuch tarbut, language, education, and culture, and protects the holy place of all religions. It's in Israel's Declaration of Independence. Yet, Judaism is the state's official religion, and other religions are recognized and allowed freedom of worship, their own court system, religious court system, marital registry, etc. But should it be allowed? Not in Israel, but in a Torah state. What would a Torah state say about having other religions openly practiced under the rubric of the Torah state? Well, at first glance, the Torah is harsh when it comes to the presence of idolatry in the land of Israel. The Torah says, in Dvarim, Poschan to be precise, U'nisonam Hashem lefanecha v'kisam, God will give them before you, you will smite them. Hacharen tacharim osam, you shall surely extirpate them. Lo tzichros lahem bris v'lo tzichonem, do not make any covenant with the idolaters, nor should you show them any favor. Rashi says, lo tzichonem al titein lahem chaniya ba'aretz, you cannot even give them residence in the land. See, here the Rambam elaborates in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, Perek Yud, Halacha Vav. Ein kol dvarim hadvar me'elu amurim ela bizman shegolu Yisrael levein odei kochavim oshiat akum tekif al Yisrael. All the compromise only when we're weaker, we're in exile, av bizman sheyad Yisrael tekif aleihem. When we are dominant, asur lanu lahaniach odei kochavim beineinu, we're not allowed to let an idolater live amongst us. Afil Yoshedi Shiva Sarai, even if they're living temporarily. Oh, over me mokum lo mokum bischoro lo yavar bartseinu. Even if they're coming on business, they can't even transit in the land of Israel, can't traverse it at all. Had she kabel all of Sheva Mitzvahs b'nei Noach, Shenestavu b'nei Noach, Shenema lo yeshu bartsecho, afil lefisho. They can't even spend more than an hour at the airport. We can't allow them to bring in or to practice any idolatry in the land of Israel. Yet, in Halacha Hay, same parak, the Rambam says, famous according to Mishnah in Gittin, Mefarnesin ani evdei kochavim imani Yisrael, Mendarke Shalom. we support, we could talk to the poor idolatrous, like we do the Jews. We don't stop the poor from collecting leket shechapeh b'fnei darkei shalom. Shalom b'shlomo afil b'yam chagom b'fnei darkei shalom. We greet them. We can even greet them on their holidays, all because of darkei shalom. Well, in fact, if you're treating these akum so nicely, they're called akum for a reason. They're ovdei kachovim. They must be practicing something. You could say it's only outside Israel, but that's not necessarily so. You don't see that distinction, even in the land of Israel. And if a Jew becomes a Ger Toshov, formally accepts the Shemesh B'nai Noach, then he's allowed to live in the land. That's by all accounts today, we don't accept Ger Toshov. That's tied to the Yovel. Chazonish said, very prescient, that if we did accept Ger Toshov today, Israel will be inundated by non-Jews whom we have to support, because we have to support the poor Ger Toshov like our own. The truth is, many poskim, modern poskim, had a much more moderate attitude on this very issue of other religions in the Torah state, attributable to several factors. For example, the Meiri writes, famous Meiri in his commentary on Bava Kamma, Daf Lamed and Zayin and Beis, that we apply the strictures against Ovdei Avodah Zarah only to primitives and pagans, but not the umos hageduros bedarchei dosos v'nimusim, not by people who are bounded by faith, by culture, by etiquette, not to their culture. They're not savages. The laws of the Torah, when we spoke of, we speak of pagans, savages, not the culture of today's religions. So the Meiri held that a non-Jew who conducts himself bedarchei hayisharim v'yesh bo derech eretz, he conducts himself uprightly, he has culture, he's dignified, he can live in Israel too. The real question has... What? The Meiri? It's a good question. What source was the Meiri? He doesn't quote a source. It seems to be a svara, but in the context of how the Torah understands an Oved Avodah Zarah, it was always associated with violence, with paganism, and especially with an ideological threat to the polity in the land of Israel. So if you have people who are not violent and don't pose an ideological threat to the polity, how's that done? Like keeping a minority? That's the Meiri. But the real question has always been, what's the status of the two major religions, Islam and Christianity? So Islam was, by most Rishonim, except for the Ran, not considered Avodah Zarah. It is violent, though. But nor was it necessarily considered as a fulfillment of the Noahide laws, since the Rambam says that requires acceptance of those Sheva Mitzvos, because God commanded them at Sinai, and not through Chidush Hadas. Chidush Hadas is considered a bad thing, creating your own religion. Christianity has always been a tougher sell. The Rambam explicitly writes in Avodah Zarah because of the man-God problem, which, you know, we're living through this week. Today the question narrows down to the prohibition of shituf, of combining God with another entity. So the question is how they understand the Trinity, how we would understand the Trinity, how Jesus fits into the Trinity. So everyone holds that for Jews, shituf, meaning God plus something else, is clearly Avodah Zarah, and the machlokas really is, what about non-Jews? Some say for non-Jews it's not Avodah Zarah, it's also anyway, but it's not Avodah Zarah, and others say that it's not prohibited at all to non-Jews, because at least they're accepting God, although they are distorting the concept. Much depends on how we define basic Christian beliefs. So it's an open question, but there's no doubt, as time marches on, especially in America, and you have all the different denominations, some strike as more idolatrous than others. So it's not just a one uniform religion. If one maintains that it's not idolatrous, we can understand why, for example, Rav Herzog permitted what he called sovlanut ha-pulchan, tolerance of worship, even for Christians. And Rav Ben Sio Meir Chayuziel, who's also chief rabbi, Sephardic variety, he agreed as well. Why? Because it's not what it once was. It's different. They're now filled with nimusim. And certainly in America we've experienced it more than European Jews did. The other area that bears mention was underscored by Rav Henkin, the Sridei Eish, and even by the others I mentioned as well. It's a more practical area. The world has changed. Like the Meiri stated, many of the distinctions between Jews and non-Jews in financial matters, legal matters, personal rights, no longer pertain to civilized people. In fact, the Sridhe Esh wrote that you shouldn't even have to write that the way we treated Oved Avodah Zarah in business, if a guy kills your chamor, etc., or you kill a guy's chamor, shouldn't you have to write that doesn't apply in which it's so obvious to any sensible person? And Rav Herzog added that to deny freedom of religion to non-Jews in a Jewish state might engender similar discrimination to Jews in the rest of the world, so that this would become a classic expression of the leniencies that come about mishum eivah, because of potential enmity. Nevertheless, it's still an open question. We tend now to be more tolerant. I must tell you that it always struck me as odd, and even again this week, that the JNF distributes trees to non-Jews in Israel this week. And that's our tzedakah money. That's our tzedakah money. So I always justify it by maintaining that those trees needed to be pruned and cut anyway. So we're not really losing. But I mean, if even they may be allowed to worship, but do we have to assist them in their worship? All right, that remains a question. In summary, the Lemon test from Lemon versus Kurtzman, from my reading at least, is preposterous in a Jewish context and has been interpreted in America in a way that makes it almost equally absurd as well. In a Jewish state, going back to the three prongs, all legislation should have some religious purpose, and all should promote Judaism, while respecting the worship by a properly constituted and limited minority of their freedom of worship. Government need not be entangled in religion, it was the Lemon paranoia, but it can be subtly supportive, even in the Jewish state, overtly supportive. After all, that's why we are in the land of Israel. For the United States, from where I stand, Lemon has shifted the balance so far in furtherance of the notion that government shall not establish a religion that it has almost completely overwhelmed the guarantee of the free exercise of religion. But perhaps that is the purpose of the Torah state, to convey to the world that Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. I thank you very much. Next time, I think we'll look at the affirmative action cases and what the Torah says about such a concept.